I sort of have this new litmus test. Have you placed a digital device on a patient before? That's it. That's my litmus test. And if you haven't or haven't seen it happen, then come back to me when you have.
Dr. Brennan Spiegel is a clinical researcher on the front lines of digital health exploration, reminding us through his eloquent writing of technology's limitation as well as potential. We're looking forward to discussing both with him on the show today.
This is Technonics, the podcast focused on the people and passion at the intersection of technology and health. I'm Lisa Soonan.
And I'm David Chewitz.
I love this.
We zoom in alone, protecting the Hebrew race. We're Jews out in space. If trouble appears, we'll put it right back in its place. When Goyim attack us, we'll give them a smack, we'll slap them right back in the face.
So that's from the classic Mel Brooks movie, History of the World, Part 1. Farzad has even called me out on Twitter for excessively quoting Treasure Bath, Dom DeLuise's famous line. And then, of course, there's Mel Brooks as King Louis XVI. My people, I love my people. Pull, and of course, it's good to be the king. Anyway, my understanding, Brennan, is that as a kid, you grew up playing with props from this movie.
That's true. Yeah, I was best friends with Max Brooks, Mel Brooks and Anna Bancroft's son, in elementary school.
Wow. Well played.
Yeah, you know it. I knew I was strategic, I guess. But yeah, we had the Jews in Space spaceship, the actual Star of David, that we destroyed that thing. We'd throw it around and the dog would chew on it. And every so often, Dom DeLuise would literally walk in, sometimes with a piece of pizza.
Very nice.
And just sort of check in and see how we're doing.
So what's this? So you grew up in L.A. How did you? Where's your screenplay?
Yeah, I'm one of the few who hasn't written one yet. But I did. I definitely grew up in L.A.
But it's there in your head somewhere, right?
Oh, everyone's got a story to tell. So, yeah, I just haven't put it to paper
what's
yet.
What's the screenplay
waiting,
you'd write?
For the right moment.
What's the screenplay you'd write if you were going to put it down? What's
I can't tell that.
How did you wind up in medicine? What was your journey?
Well, you know, it started in high school. I loved biology. I loved how the human body worked. And, you know, like a lot of people that go into medicine, I enjoyed interacting with people, and I enjoyed the social sciences and psychology, and eventually I learned all about formal logic. I was a philosophy major, and somehow I had to figure out how to use that.
How did that work out? Yeah.
Turns out can't make any kind of revenue doing that.
Well, I'll tell you, I use formal logic more than I ever thought I would in everyday medicine. So it actually has influenced a lot of what I do.
But then you wind up doing medical school and then going into GI in particular. How did you pick that?
You know, you have to have a certain sense of humor, I think, to go into GI.
GI and urology, right?
Yeah, there's a little bit of that. You know, we spend a lot of time pulling things out of nether regions, and have to kind of have a sense of humor to do something like that. Part of it was just, I can tell you stories. You won't believe the stories that I can tell you.
Are those the props that ended up in?
I think.
Are those the props that ended up in Mel Brooks' next movie?
Yeah, that's the screenplay that I've got, actually.
But the gerbil stuff is totally not true, right?
Yeah, no comment. Gerbil is just the beginning of the kind of stuff we could find.
All right.
Wow.
All right.
Yeah. Okay.
Alrighty.
Yeah.
So Brennan and I first met when in a previous role I had, when I was in a pharma company. We were looking to develop a formal measure to assess a particular GI disease, and there are any number of companies you can contract with to do this. But I specifically sought out Brennan because of his incredible sophistication around clinical research and his career interest in using science and technology in the service of patients. He's incredibly patient-driven, and I've always deeply resonated with that point of view. How did you wind up going from becoming a doctor to becoming interested in clinical research and in patient-oriented research in particular?
You know, as a doctor, we take care of patients, you know, one at a time. You know, I also teach public health, but my orientation is that we think of a healthcare system like a living, breathing organism. Then the cellular unit of that organism is the patient-provider relationship. It's a patient and a provider standing together, usually within four walls of a room, and talking. And we have to deeply and fully understand that communication, because if we improve that cellular unit and then amplify it, you know, tens and thousands and hundreds of thousands of times and more, then healthcare systems can be more efficient.
Although sometimes the cellular units go awry and create cancer, and it seems to me that we've got some really screwed up patient-provider situations right now. I mean, really, the world of value, quote-unquote, the move to value-based delivery and payment and all that is, you know, what we talk about. But there's still, I think, the motivations, the dynamics, the incentives are still woefully misaligned some of the time.
Yeah, there's a crisis, particularly in primary care, right, where there's less and less time to do more and more stuff. Being screwed on the one end to, you know, maintain a certain level of quality, and the screws on the other end are tightening to make sure that we have enough throughput and revenue. And yet we're also doing this now with in managed care contracts, yet most of us were never trained to really think about that. So there's a lot of forces going in different directions that are making it very hard to be a doctor these days.
So how does that play out tangibly in your day-to-day practice? I mean, what is the thing that happens that you wish didn't happen anymore?
Well, I'm probably not the best person to talk with because I spend a lot of time thinking about other people working really hard, and I'm usually behind a desk. But when I'm in my clinic, it's a reality, right? There's a certain number of patients we need to see. We have a certain amount of time. So what can we do to maximize that proverbial 15 minutes so that we truly do listen to our patients, understand their deep and complex biopsychosocial illness experiences, explain to them in a way that's understandable for all of us what's happening, make sure we employ shared decision-making and making complex and complicated decisions, and then, of course, meticulously document all of that in the electronic health record that's physically and emotionally separating us from our patients.
That
and
sounds
do all
like
that 15 minutes.
Haul for 15, high hurdle for 15 minutes.
Do you actually find that consumers and that in the environment you're taking care of patients when you do in the clinic, are they actually becoming more engaged? Is it really happening, or is that just stuff we say to ourselves on the healthcare system side?
I think it's variable. You know, there's lots of different kinds of people, and some people are definitely more engaged. I think the patient provider portal, for example, is one kind of digital technology. Does provide benefits. People can see their labs, they can receive education, they come in a little bit more informed than they might otherwise have because they see that they have abnormal labs and want to understand what they mean.
Are you guys on Open Notes yet?
Yes, we have started Open Notes and have piloted it.
What's been your experience with that? Do patients typically tend to read what you note, what you write down? Has it impacted what they, what you write down or what they say about it?
Me, not at all. It doesn't change what I write. I always, in fact, sometimes I will dictate a note even with the patient in the room so they can hear what I'm saying in real time and make corrections identify if I've made an error. So this is sort of, for me, kind of embedded in the way I think about writing notes. I always think about the patient reading a note or anyone else reading a note that I'm writing. To me, the electronic health record or any health record should be a record of shared decision-making, not a record of what we're doing to patients, but a platform to help make decisions with patients. But that's my point of view. And, you know, not everyone necessarily agrees with that.
And why don't they, what do you think? What are the protagonists on the other side? Why do they believe it's a bad idea?
These evil paternalists.
Yeah. Well, you know, the usual argument is that the language that we speak, this medical language is somehow too obtuse or complicated for everyone to understand, and it could be misunderstood. I can write something that we understand but is not understood by a patient, and that could lead to complicated discussions and misunderstandings and so on. That's not what we've seen. We have not seen that in our Open Notes pilot, though.
Yeah, Bob Wachter has also been very enthusiastic. So many people who use it have actually been very enthusiastic. I almost wonder if it's like a generational thing where there's a perception where, oh my gosh, we have to protect patients from our notes. We have to be able to communicate freely with other physicians. And that just sounds like such a dated view. I wanted to transition to a little bit of a different topic. The idea of, so one of your areas of expertise is sort of patient-reported outcomes is, in general, the idea of how does a patient experience the illness that they have. And you talked about how you typically see a patient, like you're saying, in the four walls of a hospital. And one of the big premises of digital health is the idea that, you know, a patient's illness, as you've written about as eloquently as anyone I've ever seen, is something that's with them every day, that's part of their life experience. And so the challenge as a physician is how do you understand, how do you capture, how do you understand that? How is that aspect of illness reflected and understood effectively? Is that something that, was that one of your hopes? Is that one of your hopes for digital health?
Absolutely, right. I mean, you know, we take care of people for 15 to 20 minutes at a time in this room that bears no resemblance to any other room you ever see anywhere else in your life. It has this weird table chair and sinks, and it's beige. It's kind of like going to the DMV. You know you have to go to the DMV. You're going to wait in line. You're going to get something out of it, but you don't want to be there. And then you go home, and you don't live at the DMV, and you don't live at the doctor's office. So people spend 99.9% of their lives outside of those four walls. They're at the park, they're at senior centers, they're at work, they're at home. So how are we as doctors supposed to understand that complex biopsychosocial history sitting in this beige room, you know, in a clinic?
Right.
We can't. There's no chance. So digital health, of course, offers a platform or set of platforms where we can reach out. And one of the best examples that I can think of is the NIH Promise Initiative, patient-reported outcome measurement information system. And what Promise sought out to do over 10 years ago now through the NIH was to create a set of patient-reported outcomes that cross the breadth and depth of the human illness experience. And these are electronically administered and can be scored and presented to doctors through the electronic health record. And we use Promise in our clinics at Cedars-Sinai now to take care of our patients.
So what do you think about, you know, I think, you know, taken to its logical extreme, the patient experience that the FDA just announced that they're going to have a panel of consumers, patients, who are going to gauge in the oversight process for each new drug and device that comes through the FDA and give their input about the patient's view of that. What do you think of that?
I think it's terrific. I mean, at the end of the day, patients are our customers. And just like any other market research, you want to understand what the use case is for your customers, for any new product. And our customers, our patients, know what is important to them in their lives. They know what defines success, and they can define that and describe it as well as anybody can.
So to that end, what are some of the examples you've seen of discrepancies? Are there several examples that come to mind of instances where physicians or providers had one sense of this is what a patient prioritizes, but then when you actually, EGAD, speak with patients and understand their experience of illness, you discover something entirely different? What are examples of that that come to mind? And it doesn't have to involve digital health. I'm just sort of curious about.
Yeah, no, there's so many. I mean, it's easy to think of examples. So, you know, for example, in irritable bowel syndrome, or IBS, very, very common condition, about 10% of the population has this condition. It's marked by recurrent abdominal pain and diarrhea or constipation, bloating, can really affect people's quality of life. And what do doctors really look for? Well, what are the questions we ask? We say, how many bowel movements have you had today? How many bowel movements are you having per day? What does the poop look like? We have a scale for what poop looks like. There's seven different types of poop. I don't know if you knew that, but there's seven different types of bowel movements. And we literally have a scale.
Oh, we have that in our study, so I'm aware of that, but yeah.
Yeah, right, you're aware. And, you know, that's how patients can answer those questions. But at the end of the day, you know, I've never had a patient come to me and say, you know what, doctor?
What kind of poop
I've been looking
do I
at
have?
My poop.
It's more of a three than a five, yeah.
Yeah, it looks too firm. Right. I need you to loosen it up. Like, that's not a conversation we have. They say, I'm straining, I can't get it out, I can't go to work, I can't, you know. It's all about how it impacts their
so to
life
speak.
Experience.
Yeah,
yeah, well, you know, I think in our business, you know, my business anyway, it's either hitting the fan or it's not. You know, there's only two measures in my view of the world. So how do you get patients to talk about sensitive subjects like that? Because I think most people, certainly the patients are uncomfortable a lot of the time, and oftentimes the physicians are uncomfortable. You know, it's just this big study that I think it was Kaiser Family Foundation did talking about end of life, for instance. And, and so much of that is the psychosocial side of things, not the bio side of things. And, you know, the study revealed that, you know, some large number, I don't remember, it was 50% or close to 50% of doctors felt uncomfortable talking about these issues with patients. How do you get that conversation fluid between patients and providers in a way that has a better outcome?
I mean, there are some really easy techniques that anybody could adopt. And in fact, we've trained a computer to do this. We might talk about that.
It's easier than training a doctor.
Yeah, it is easier to train a doctor. It turns out computers do, in some cases, a much better job at taking a history than a doctor, and maybe we'll talk about that. But just asking, you know, before we start a visit, I sometimes will say to a patient, you know, what would be a success today? What, you know, what do you really need to get out of today? How can I help you? I mean, when was the last time your doctor asked you that question at the beginning of a visit and said, what would be a successful visit for you?
Well, they ask me that when I go to Nordstrom's, but not when I go to the doctor.
Right. The other thing I sometimes ask, if things just feel a little bit unusual or a little disconnected, or I can't quite piece together what's happening, I might say, you know, is there anything about you or your life that you want to tell me that will help me better understand what's happening with you? This open-ended question. And it's amazing what kind of responses I get from that question.
So what would be an example of an unexpected response you've had in that situation?
Well, for example, I asked that question of a recent, of a Gulf War vet recently in the VA. And he's had chronic abdominal pain, and he's just sort of toughing it out. And I asked him that question, and he started to cry. And he said, you know what, ever since I was in Tikrit with this, you know, running around, banging down doors, not knowing who's on the other side of that door, I'd have to smash it down. I'd be the first guy in the line with a gun at my ear. And I never knew what was going to be around that door. And I would, thank God, make it home back to the barracks where I would crawl up in a fetal position in the corner and cry. And he said, and I've never shook that from my head, and the pain, the searing pain in my belly has never gone away since that moment.
Yikes.
Gosh.
So what do you do for a patient like that? Do you send them to this, you know, mental health unit instead?
Well, right. I mean, that's a complex situation that requires multidisciplinary expertise, you know, cognitive psychotherapy, and I don't need to loosen up his stools, put it that way.
Right.
We're going to need to do more than that.
Right. To get back to one of the things you had mentioned about how sometimes, you know, the idea of people, you were joking, but can be more comfortable discussing with a computer. I've actually heard that in the context of some of the people who develop avatar-based programs. They say, for example, for discharge summary is one example I've heard, that in some instances, because that they feel like healthcare providers are so either rushed or judgmental, that there are some activities that they actually feel more comfortable about discussing or describing to an avatar, to a computer, to a system, than they would to an actual human being. That's so peculiar, but I guess it makes sense. Do you have thoughts on that?
Yeah, we've tested this directly. So there is literature to support that patients, not all, but many patients are more comfortable, honest, and open responding to, let's say, a questionnaire than to a human. And this is particularly important going back to my background as a gastroenterologist. We're talking about a lot of sensitive things, poop and farts and, you know, things that we all kind of joke around about, and there's a stigma. And, you know, we programmed a computer to take a history, and this history will compose itself from what the patient says, and it formats itself into a history presenting illness, or an HPI, that we can see through an electronic health record. And we had one amazing example where this resident comes out of her room and is very upset. She says, you know, this computer is all wrong because it says that the patient can't have a bowel movement unless she sticks her finger in her bottom to pull out the bowel movement. And she denies that. She denies it. I said, is this a court of law? I mean, really, she denies it? What do you mean? This is language that we use in medicine. Oh, patient denies this and patient denies that. And it's no wonder why patients sometimes are concerned about talking with us. Well, in that case, it turned out the computer was right, and the patient was so embarrassed and didn't feel comfortable even acknowledging that she had written that to the computer. So wow. There's many examples like that.
Is age the determinant of that discomfort, or people who are younger and who are, you know, more used to texting and don't ever actually look into other human eyes because they're always looking at their phones, more comfortable talking to technological avatar type things than older people, or is it just a universal thing?
Well, we have seen a digital divide with willingness to use, you know, these computer systems to take histories. In that particular example, that woman was probably 64, if I recall correctly. So there's always exceptions on both sides.
Yeah, I mean, I guess the issue of manual disimpaction may not, you know, lend itself to casual conversation, one imagines.
That's right. Right.
I wanted to get to, so you've written some incredibly powerful post, Brennan, about what has happened, your experience of actually implementing digital health. There's all this techno-utopianism around this sort of, oh my gosh, if you just put sensors on people, then and you know, wow, everything changes and it's just better, you know, the world's improved. And then you're on the front lines, you're doing that. And you've described a situation, you know, a real world experience of doing with this that seems different from what I read from folks like Koshla. Could you talk about some of the experiences that you've had when you actually, you know, gave someone virtual reality goggles or try to put sensors on people? Or I know that you strongly believe in the promise of the technology and just believe this is sort of a learning curve. But what were some of the things that you've stumbled across as you've been on the process of this learning experience?
Right. Yeah. So I am a technophile and I do believe in the power of this. So when I go through these examples, I could be misinterpreted as being a naysayer.
Right.
And I'm not a naysayer, but I do see the limitations, and I sort of have this new litmus test for any proselytizer. My litmus test is, have you placed a digital device on a patient before? That's it. That's my litmus test. And if you haven't or haven't seen it happen, then come back to me when you have. Because we put a lot of sensors on people. And
so
what happens next?
Yeah, tell us what's happened.
Like what? Give an example of that, if you would.
Yeah, so there's many. So you mentioned virtual reality. So we're doing a study right now, really excited about it, at Cedars-Sinai, where we are using virtual reality goggles in our inpatients. And you think about what happened in the hospital. You're either, you know, sitting around bored in this desolate room doing nothing in a bed, or you're punctuated by these moments of fear, anxiety, pain. It's a terrible place to be. So
it's like being at your family at Thanksgiving.
Yeah, okay, all right. I'll let that one sit. So, you know, wouldn't it make sense to bring somebody to Iceland or to a beautiful beach or, you know, to a Cirque du Soleil performance on the stage and be into this immersive three-dimensional world that can distract you?
Lisa wants
and bring
to be in
away.
An immersive world with The Rock, but okay. I'm not kidding, but go ahead.
Okay.
Yeah, go ahead.
So there's a lot of literature about this. It can distract people from pain, reduce pain medication, and so on. So one of the first day we started this study after, you know, waiting to get IRB approval, we had to approach 10 people before one would even be willing to put the goggles on their face. And one of the first rooms I walked into is this 45-year-old woman who a month before had a cold, and she couldn't shake the cold, and it wasn't getting better. And she finally got a chest x-ray that showed that she had severe metastatic lung cancer, and she's not a smoker. And she is literally on her deathbed, and I walk in with a pair of goggles. And I explain the situation to her, that we can, you know, transport you to this place and that place. And she's looking at me. If her eyes, you know, could speak, lasers would have come out and fried me into a heap of ash.
Right.
You know, if she said what she was really on her mind, I walked out of that room ashamed.
Wow.
And I realized at that moment that we're talking about real people, patients, who can give a damn about a pair of virtual reality goggles. And that was my first day with this study.
You know, there's this thing I'm sure you've heard of called the Gartner Hype Cycle, which is Gartner Group
sure.
started, you know, and it seems to me like the vendors are all out there with the, you know, at the peak of inflated expectations, right? The top of the mountain where everything's so fabulous. And the doctors a lot of times, though optimistic or at least hopeful of the value of technology, have already made it through to the trough of disillusionment, as Gardner would call
right.
it. They're in the sewer on this because of what you just described, that gap between the promise and the reality. So what does it take
right.
to bridge that gap? How do you make some of these things into something good?
Right, yeah. So I've slid down into the trough along with others. But again, the slope of enlightenment, I think.
There you go.
Next.
Yeah,
that's
what
right.
right? comes next.
I know
right.
my Gartner
Nicely
hype cycle.
Done. Nicely done.
Thank you. Was that awesome?
Absolutely.
So, yeah, that's what comes next. So, how are we going to start leveraging up?
Lisa's going to return the favor by naming the three parts of the small intestine. So.
I can get three of the seven kinds of poop, maybe.
We can get into the etymology of why the jejunum is called the jejunum. That's very interesting. But again, another show, I think.
Yeah, when you come back. But okay, go ahead. But go ahead. How are we going to get up the slope of this? Of
so you know, how are we going to get there? Well, I think so. Let me give you one more example that might be helpful. And then we can talk about how that's an example of moving in the right direction. So we're doing another study where we're using activity monitors in people with rheumatoid arthritis. And these patients are receiving really effective therapy, biologic therapy for their rheumatoid arthritis. And we're monitoring their movement, their steps. And we're using this really fancy gyroscope that goes on the ankle, working with our colleagues in electrical engineering at UCLA, and comparing it to their actual patient-reported outcomes. How tired are they? How much pain are they in? What kind of stiffness do they have? And the very first patient in this study, we're monitoring her electronically, and we see that she is not walking. She started out walking all over the place, and then as 4 weeks went by, she walked less and less and less, to the point where she was almost stationary. But at the same time, we're monitoring how she's doing, and she says she's feeling great. She's feeling better than she's ever felt in her life. Hmm. So we thought, well, there must be a problem with the sensors. We must not be wearing them correctly. Maybe the battery died. And for her, success is going back to work. And work, for her, is sitting at a desk writing a book. And she explained that she's never felt better in her life. She finally can sit down without joint pain and write her book for 11 hours at a time.
Wow.
So it just immediately, our very first patient undermined all of our presuppositions about what we should be looking for. And that healthy people are walking around, and we're going to see that.
Talk about patient-reported outcomes, right? I mean, that is the prime example.
It is. So what does that mean for getting up the slope of enlightenment? You know, I think that it's pretty clear that, you know, in this case, wearable sensor data is one stream of data. It's one channel of data. It has to be put into a broader context. It has to be put into a biopsychosocial context. And if we think about, you know, Bob Wachter's work and thinking about this new type of doctor, the digitalist, you know, he described the hospitalist, you know, what, 20 years ago now or more. The digitalist is a new doctor and who doesn't really exist yet, who in theory is trained to understand patients and understand their biopsychosocial illness journeys and also understands digital data and can sit in some e-coordination hub looking at incoming data from mobile health applications, PROs, from wearables, and understands the patient's medical and surgical problems, and can try and integrate all of that, which might mean actually calling up the patient and talking to them.
Oh my God, not actually talking to them.
Right.
If all else fails, yeah.
Yeah, so I think that's where we're headed, and that's complex, but it's doable if we start developing systems that support it.
We have to breed a whole new race of super doctors.
With the power to expand time. Brennan, do you want to talk about the one other example? I think it's kind of a sad but inspiring that you presented of the use of big data to impact clinical care. The example that you wrote about where being able to integrate information actually had explicit clinical relevance on the care of patients.
Yeah, right. Absolutely. I mean, this is an amazing example to me of digital health getting it just right. And it comes out of Harvard.
There you go, Lisa.
It always comes out of freaking Harvard.
There you go, Lisa.
Go Bears.
Smarty pants. But
oh, please.
It comes out of Harvard. And the idea here was, you know, this kind of ties back to the earlier part of our conversation. There's certain things doctors don't want to talk about, patients don't want to talk about. And domestic violence is a really compelling example. And, you know, what these folks did is they figured out that there is a very unique telltale pattern of consulting behavior that predicts the likelihood of domestic abuse or domestic violence. And for example, it doesn't have to be a woman, it could be a man, but if a woman, let's say, is going to the urologist and then goes to the GI doctor for unexplained abdominal pain, and then has sort of neuropathy symptoms, and then is in the emergency department with a jaw injury, that woman has a high likelihood of domestic violence based upon a computer algorithm.
But none of the individual
doctors is going to miss it. What's that?
No, I was hoping you'd mention that about how each individual doctor doesn't really see the complete picture.
That's right. If that woman comes to me, I'm going to focus on her abdominal pain. And maybe it'll come out in the course of a discussion, but maybe it won't. Maybe I'll ask, maybe I won't ask. But the computer is dutifully paying attention, integrating the whole picture and starting to draw this horrific portrayal of domestic violence and then bringing it to the attention of the doctors.
And then is able to allow them to augment their diagnostic skills and enable them to actually help this person who they wouldn't have otherwise recognized as somebody in need of a different type of assistance. Is that right?
Right, exactly.
All right. So we're nearing the end of our time here. We're thrilled by the work that you're doing, and we're just so grateful that you were able to join us on the show today.
Yeah, it's fascinating. I mean, I think, you know, we who spend a lot of time in digital health, not from the laying on of hands side of things, sometimes are too disconnected from that to really understand where the rubber meets the road. So it's great to hear concrete examples of how that manifests itself and what can be done to do it better.
And what the intersection looks like and what people such as you who are at the intersection are doing to really drive the promise of this into reality. Thanks so much for joining us today, Brennan.
Great to have you.
Thanks so much for having me on. Appreciate it.
Wow. That was such an interesting contrast to the show we did a few weeks ago with Matthew and Indu, where there seems to be such an emphasis on the promise of technology. And here, this is really more an example of what happens when you try to implement it.
So true. And if you'd like to hear more about what we're doing, you can, of course, find that on my blog at Venture Valkyrie or David's on Forbes. And our podcast, of course, can always be found there or on iTunes.
Lisa will be sure to include a link to the Bristol Stool Scale so that you can find all seven types of stool for your viewing pleasure. Thanks so much for listening. I'm David Chewitz.
I'm Lisa Soonan. Thanks for listening.